1580 AM Columbus, W224 EG Madison, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. The White House says President Biden met with G7 leaders today where they condemned Iran's attack on Israel and reaffirmed the G7's commitment to Israel's security. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby.
They also showed Iran that Israel does have friends, that there was a coalition that helps them support themselves. That alone is significant. And of course, the damage was extremely light.
While reassuring Israel that U.S. support is ironclad, Kirby saying that the U.S. does not want to see further escalation between Iran and Israel or a broadening battle in the Middle East. The U.S. was instrumental in preventing a large number of missiles heading toward Israel, intercepting nearly a quarter of the weapons before they reached their intended targets. Today, Iran warning the U.S. to keep out of any future hostilities between it and Israel. And this afternoon, an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council to discuss the developments in the Middle East. This is ABC News. It could be a tough week for Boeing as Congress prepares to hear from a whistleblower about alleged safety lapses at the aircraft maker. ABC's Jay O'Brien has more from Washington.
He previously detailed what he claims are engineering issues with the way the fuselage of a 787 Dreamliner is put together. Boeing has called his concerns inaccurate and said the issues raised by the whistleblower were subject to rigorous engineering examination under FAA oversight and found to not present any safety concerns. That same Senate subcommittee has requested that Boeing CEO Dave Calhoun testify, the company not saying this morning if he plans to comply with that request.
Oklahoma authorities have arrested four people in connection with the disappearance of two Kansas moms. Jillian Kelly and Veronica Butler were going to pick up Butler's children on March 30th, but they never arrived. They've been missing for nearly 2 weeks now after the car was found abandoned near the Oklahoma-Kansas border. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Why choose Weichert Realtors? Because your community is our community. We're your neighbors, your students, your chefs, your soldiers, your builders, your actors, your musicians, and your radio personalities. We love this city as much as you do, and that's why we want to help you live your best life here. Because we are your realtors. Call us today and let us help you find your next home. 608-821-7002 or visit Weichert-LakePoint.com. Weichert Realtors Lake Point, a home for all.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
4 Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Indigenous leaders will tell a United Nations panel Monday about their ongoing concerns with a controversial oil pipeline in northern Wisconsin. Mike Moan reports.
Enbridge Energy's Line 5 operation is likely to come up when the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues convenes in New York. Back in the Midwest, organizations like Earth Justice represent the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. The tribe has been contesting Line 5 in Wisconsin as Enbridge seeks to reroute the pipeline. Earth Justice attorney Stephanie Sosi says the proposal is not an improvement in minimizing the effect on tribal lands.
The Bad River Band is already at a risk of an oil spill because the pipeline is going directly through their reservation, and the reroute, I mean, if you look at the map, it's basically hugging the reservation boundaries.
She says her team is preparing for litigation if permits for the reroute are issued. The tribe has previously filed lawsuits against Line 5 in an effort to shut it down, prompting the latest route plans. Similar cases have been active in Michigan. Enbridge argues the pipeline is a key source of energy and rejects claims and legal decisions that it's trespassing on tribal lands. On the Michigan side, opponents say they're worried about Enbridge's latest Line 5 plans to construct an oil tunnel beneath the Straits of Mackinac, a connecting waterway. The company says it would be safer than the existing pipeline section, But Native American Rights Fund attorney Wes Furlong says there's real concern about a worst-case scenario.
If a leak happened within that tunnel, it would cause a catastrophic failure, pumping crude oil into the Straits and into the Great Lakes.
First built in 1953, the pipeline can transport up to 23 million gallons of oil and natural gas liquids per day. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Tune in Monday to the Devil's Advocates radio show. The trial of the century. Donald Trump will have all the coverage 4 to 6 statewide.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price for your Sunday. Sunny skies at mid-70s for highs. Northwest winds will be rather light. Tonight, clear skies at mid-40s. On Monday, sunny, lower 70s expected, a southeast breeze, showers, even a few rumbles of thunder Monday night. Right now, it's 76.
There's nothing better than the Violet Zoo and the Old Brick Gardens.
Except maybe Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX.
Hey, folks, welcome to the Cripescast. This is the podcast where we talk to people for and or from the Midwest. I am your host, Charlie Behrens, and we are powered by Everlight Solar. Hey, folks, how's it going? Welcome to another episode of the Cripescast. Today, my guest is fisheries biologist Max Walter. He works for the Department of Natural Resources in Wisconsin. And we are talking all about fishing. A lot of you folks know I'm kind of an environment nerd, and I'm really interested in what is going on with the walleyes this year, specifically because of what happened with the ice over the winter, or really the lack of winter. There wasn't a lot of ice due to climate change and all that. And how is that impacting the fishing we can expect to see for the rest of the year? And how is this changing climate sort of affecting fish populations in Wisconsin overall? Wisconsin is home to some really incredible species of trout, muskie, and walleye, and all these fish, every species is going to be somewhat changed or drastically changed when it comes to climate change. So we're talking with Max about that. We're talking about what you can do, what you can be aware of, as whether you're a conservationist, whether you're a fisherman, or fisherwoman, I don't even know how you properly say that, fishing person who enjoys catching fish out of body of water, however you want to say it. But yeah, I was very into this. And of course, we addressed the elephant in the room, ladies and gentlemen. A couple years ago, there were rumors of prostitution being an issue in the ice fishing community. We find out from Max if that is true in Wisconsin. Not going to spoil that for you. So anyways, we're going to get to my interview with Max in a second. Hey, listen, before we do get into the podcast, I just want to say we are continuing to raise money for Doctors Without Borders. They are doing and continue to do great work in around the world, but especially in the Middle East right now. You can donate doctorswithoutborders.org. Here is my guest, fisheries biologist for the Wisconsin DNR, Max Walter. So, yeah, man, crazy winter we had for fishing in the state and really across the country. What are your thoughts on all that?
Yeah, that's the big thing we're dealing with right now is a very unfamiliar looking spring. It's super early, of course. It's very, very dry. We don't have that snow melt coming down the rivers. So we're still kind of taking stock of what that's going to mean for fish and how they're all reacting, when the spawn's going to happen in a lot of these places. So kind of uncharted waters, I guess, literally in many cases here.
Have we ever had a winter like this before?
Not in my time working for the DNR, for sure. I mean, we had another early one in 2017, but that still had a lot of snow and, you know, we had good ice cover and then it just melted really fast when it got warm. It's weird to just have a winter like this where we had basically no snow up north. You know, I'm in Hayward, so the Berkey was doing all sorts of heroic things to make snow that people could ski on. And so, yeah, we're really dry. Water levels are low.
I guess one question is what can, obviously it's an El Nino year, but what other factors have been at play? Because we've had several El Nino years and nothing has ever been like this.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we did kind of know that that was going to be the trend this winter, was going to be a little bit warmer, a little bit drier. But, you know, all the predictions for climate change are saying this is the type of thing we should be expecting, which is more variation in the types of winters we're going to have. Some of them are, might be really, really wet like last winter, and then the next one might be really, really dry, less ice cover on the lakes, earlier springs. And that's a challenge for fish, especially if you think about a fish like walleye, one of the favorites in Wisconsin. They're developing those eggs with the expectation that spawning is going to happen at a certain time, that the ice is going to go out typically in mid-April in northern Wisconsin. Eggs will be ready to go. Ice goes out, eggs get laid, boom, we're good to go. The challenge now is, well, what if the ice goes out significantly earlier than the walleye are ready for and those eggs aren't fully developed yet? What does that mean for hatching success and their ability to actually create year classes? And that can go in the other direction too. What if we have a really, really late year and all the spawning happens in kind of a rush? That can be a problem as well. So inconsistency, typically not good. And unfortunately with the climate predictions, that's what we're in for, is a lot more inconsistency.
So, and what does that mean for, so obviously climate change is the culprit here. And what does that mean for people who like to fish walleye? I mean, does that mean that it's possible the walleye could go away, or would you not take it that far?
I wouldn't take it that far. There's going to be places to fish for walleye in Wisconsin for a long, long time. There are certainly water bodies that are going to be very resilient to climate change. We've done a lot of modeling to show what those are. It's bigger systems, it's flowing systems, it's systems that are cooler or colder on average. But people's opportunities are going to be limited by losing walleye populations in a lot of these more like marginal lakes. It's already a little bit warm. It's already kind of on the edge. Climate change might push it to the point where walleye aren't as successful there as they used to be. And we've already seen that happen in a lot of places. There's been many, many water bodies around the state where walleye used to reproduce successfully, conditions were good for them, and the environment has shifted away from walleye. Their abundance is dropping, and other species like largemouth bass, panfish are kind of coming in and filling that void. And now those lakes are more suited for those particular species. That's a big deal.
So, yeah, I mean, it's almost like Wisconsin is becoming somewhat, you know, it's looking like kind of a southern fishery a little bit, where bass sort of dominate, panfish dominate. Is that accurate?
That is, you are right on the nose with that one. We were always in Wisconsin, kind of on the southern edge of the walleye's native range, right? Walleye were here. They've been successful for a long, long time, but you don't go a whole lot farther south and still have good walleye populations. So we're already kind of in that like transition zone. And now we're seeing species like largemouth bass, panfish, even catfish starting to do better in Wisconsin, because the water's warming and becoming a little more favorable for them, like it is in the southern and central United States.
Now, I was so excited to kind of jump in and figure out what's going on with the winter, because I ice fished one time and that was it. But I was so excited to do that and jump in and figure this all out, especially about the walleye, that I didn't fully introduce you. So can you tell people what it is that you do with the DNR, what your job looks like, the ins and outs?
Yeah, I do have to say, I was taken a little surprise there. I thought, wow, this podcast, this is all business here.
I wanted to get right in, man. It was all business. I mean, did not even get out for sturgeon season. It was crazy, you mm-hmm. know? So, but anyway, before I jump back into that, yeah, can you give everyone sort of an idea of what you do with the DNR?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Max Wolter. I'm a senior fisheries biologist with the Wisconsin DNR. I've been doing that for a little over 10 years. I have a variety of responsibilities. I'm the local biologist for the Hayward area, so I cover some pretty well-known lakes like the Couderay and the Chippewa Flowage, and do all things fish there. You know, recommend when we need to stock fish and help set fishing regulations with all of our partner groups, fish surveys, habitat work, all that good stuff. And then I work on some statewide teams related to walleye. I've worked on panfish. So it's all things fish, you know, it's understanding fish. It's telling people about fish, fishing opportunities, protecting fish habitat. Me and, you know, my colleagues around the state, we're the front lines for anybody who wants to make sure that fish are protected long into the future here in Wisconsin.
That was kind of a big reason I wanted to chit chat with you too, is every year I go to the Tiger Muskie Resort, over there on the flowage, Chippewa flowage. And, fishing there is phenomenal. This past summer when we were there, like, you know, we were going out, kayaking, and then you kind of look around, you're like, what is going on with the sky? I mean, you basically had all this smoke from the wildfires in Canada the whole time. I mean, it was just, have you guys seen a lot of that in play? Is that something that people who are kind of fishing up in northern Wisconsin, or frankly all of Wisconsin, can we expect more of those sort of wildfires coming in from Canada? I know that's not your expertise, but just curious if you have any thoughts on that as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a concern at this moment in time. It is actually a little bit my area expertise, because I'm a public information officer for our wildfire team up here in northern Wisconsin. And my colleagues are all listening to the radio right now, listening for fire calls in March. We typically have snow cover. We're not thinking about fires in March. So, we have a potential for a long fire season here. People have to be careful, you know, watch those burn restrictions, be smart about all that, because that's another climate impact, is more conditions that can create extreme weather events, including conditions for wildfires. So not that we're going to talk about climate change the whole time here, but it's a very real part of natural resource management right now.
Do you find that folks, your kind of other fishers out there, sportsmen, all that sort of stuff, do you find that there is still sort of a hesitance to like believe that climate change is causing this, or is that pretty much something of the past from your perspective?
That's a great question. I don't think it's completely a thing of the past. And, you know, I think it's unfortunate that climate change has become such a political thing, you know, for reasons that have nothing to do with fish and fishing and walleye or any of that kind of stuff. You know, that's all happening at a, you know, a national level. But you talk to pretty much anybody, regardless of what their politics are, especially folks that have been around for a while. And you start to ask them, like, you know, what's changed in your lake over time? And they know, like, they've been documenting and clocking these changes. There used to be a lot more perch, or yeah, we used to see more of this. And so whether they're identifying that as a climate impact or not, they're aware that things are changing. And when you have a winter like this, it's impossible to ignore it. And so that kind of creates an opening to talk to people too. And it's like, you know, our objective is not anything political here. Our objective is to create great fishing opportunities for people. And if we have to, you know, have some conversations about climate, you know, that's just part of the deal, because it's on us to understand the impacts of these things, communicate it to people and how it could affect them. And then try to come up with the best possible solutions, right? If we want to keep having a walleye lake be a walleye lake, what do we need to do to make that happen?
And so given that, let's say the lack of ice and the early spawn, and just for those who don't know what spawning is, this is the first time they're hearing that. Can you just give them the birds and the bees of the fish kind of talk here?
Yeah, absolutely. We're going there. So spawning is kind of the fisheries term for mating, right? Or reproducing. And spawning happens in a couple different ways. There are what we call broadcast spawners. So these are species that are going to go to the spawning grounds. The males and females are going to show up at a specific time. It's usually cued by environmental factors like temperature or day length. And they're going to pair up, males and females, and not to get too spicy here, but often it's more than one male for every one female. When we're looking at walleye, it's like three or four males for a female. Sturgeon, that can be pretty high too. The female is going to start releasing eggs when things are feeling good, and then the males are going to release their milt, which is the sperm. It's going to fertilize them. Then those eggs just settle to the bottom of the lake or the river, and they sit there and they develop as embryos. until they hatch, which is can be anywhere from like 5 to 10 days later. And then those little fry are totally on their own because the parents are long gone. They drop those eggs and they're out of there. So no care given for a broadcast spawner. And because of that, the strategy is you got to put thousands and thousands of eggs out there if you're a female and hope that a very, very small fraction of those are going to survive. You know, we're talking a fraction of 1% might actually survive and make it to become the next adult fish. There is another group in Wisconsin that we call nest garters. This would be your bass, your panfish, and a few other species where they are going to provide some care to those eggs. The male's going to build the nest. He's going to sit on that nest. He's going to try to, you know, entice a female to come over, lay some eggs in his spot there, fertilize them, and then he's going to protect those eggs. And a lot of people who fish have seen that where a smallmouth or a largemouth or a bluegill, they're not going to leave that nest, especially once they have eggs on it, because they're protecting them. And then the fry hatch, they protect them for a little while, and then the fry kind of start to disperse and swim off on their own. So spawning is really interesting with fish. It happens, you know, it's very different than most other animals. And people are fascinated by it because, you know, that's where the next generation of fish comes from. In a lot of cases, you can see it. You know, the sturgeon spawn on the Winnebago system is like a big, big event. Everybody wants to come and see those things, those big dinosaurs showing up and doing their thing. So yeah, that's the long and short of spawning, I think.
You know, that's some prime entertainment. You see sturgeon go after it. You know, you can film that stuff, put it on the internet, make some good money, I've heard.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Maybe we should think about that. It might be a way to raise some more revenue for the DNR, get some paywalls going or something.
There you have it. The first OnlyFans site, you know,
beautiful. Trademark that quickly.
I know, we got to. Hey, so yeah, you could do that. You could just get like the little GoPro cams. You could have underwater cam, overwater cam. Because I'll tell you this much. I remember walking into the living room on my Grandpa Bob. And you know what he was doing? He was looking at some eagle cams. And he had like three eagle cams up, man. And he was like, hey, come check this one out. See this? This is the female. She's about to kick the young out the nest. I've been waiting all day for it. And so he's waiting for that big moment. Now, I'm not sure if that's even the official way eagles do it. Do they do it? Do they like kick them out of the nest like that? I don't know how long my grandpa was sitting there watching that nest for, but I know you're a fish guy. But.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a little out of my element there with the eagles, but hey, kudos to your grandpa. I mean, whatever he's into, entertainment comes in all shapes and sizes. Yeah,
it does, man. And who am I to kink shame, you know? So, well, thanks for giving us the details on the spawning. Let me ask you this. If it doesn't go well for the spawn this year, how can you change that with like the fish hatcheries, and how much influence should a fish hatchery have on the natural ecosystem? I know you guys are always balancing that as well.
Yeah. Well, that's a great question again. So a lot of fish species, I'll just start by saying a lot of fish species are kind of built to weather some bad years, right? So even in the best populations, like a walleye population, a missed year class isn't the end of the world. So one bad year, not a problem. 3, 4, 5 in a row, now it's looking a little bit more dire. Something like sturgeon, I mean, a female sturgeon can live to be over 100 years. She might get to spawn 70 times or something. So, you know, missing a year here and there, not that big a deal either. What we're seeing is, you know, in places where spawning has been going poorly for quite a while, that's where we want to step in and we want to do some stocking to either supplement the population, try to get the abundance up and give anglers something to catch, or ideally get that population back up on its feet so that spawning will start happening again when conditions are right. And that's where our DNR hatchery system comes into the picture. We have incredible hatchery staff all around the state that are the best in the world at raising a whole bunch of different species. The things DNR spends most of our time raising are walleye. We raise a lot of walleye. Muskies, we raise quite a few of them. And then your cold water species, your trout and your salmon. We do some sturgeon as well. And the idea here is that when we're raising fish in a hatchery to stock out in the wild, we're trying to help that population get around some sort of a bottleneck early in life. Either the eggs aren't surviving or the fry aren't surviving. But if you put the fish out there at what we call a fingerling size, which is kind of a fun term, you picture a walleye like the size of your finger, right? Then they have a better chance of surviving because they're past some of those early life bottlenecks. And hopefully from there, they can take off and go. There is a lot of really interesting debate about, you know, where should or shouldn't you stock? And we work that into our decisions. We try to use native genetics. So we're going out and we're getting walleye from a wild walleye population, getting those eggs, bringing them back to our hatchery, raising them up and then stocking them out. So what we're putting out there matches what's out there in the wild to the best extent possible. And then having different genetic management units around the state too. So we're not taking fish from the St. Louis River in far northern Wisconsin and putting them into, you know, the Madison chain or something like that. We're trying to get fish locally.
Got it. And is there a downside to doing that?
To stocking or to moving fish around? Yeah. Stocking. Well, sure. I mean, one thing is stocking is expensive and we have to factor that in. You know, it's like we can introduce all these fish for free. So we have to make decisions about how much we're going to raise and how we're going to use kind of that limited resource. And then the other factors are, you know, you want to try to avoid messing with the native genetics, which I just talked about a little bit. You want to try to avoid overstocking and having too many fish in a water body where there's not enough prey available for them that can lead to poor growth and survival and things like that. So yeah, there's a lot of considerations that go into the picture of stocking and when you're going to stock. One of the challenges for us is for a lot of people, stocking is like the most popular thing we can do, right? Everybody loves the idea. Oh, they stocked the lake. They want to see that truck back up and dump fish in and believe that that's the best thing that could possibly happen. And it's a little more nuanced than that, because typically when we're stocking, it's because something's broken population, something's not working right. And that's why we have to come in and stock fish. Ideally, they'd be reproducing on their own. Everything would be healthy. Everything be looking good. And the fish would be doing it, you know, the way they did for thousands and thousands of years before we decided we wanted to get involved.
Well, what is so broken that you guys are doing the stocking to begin with? What are the biggest factors?
Yeah. It's a number of things, and it varies by species and water body and things like that. And sometimes it's, you know, the environment has been degraded because the habitat isn't in the same condition it was before. And that can happen a number of different ways. Sometimes it's the climate stuff that we talked about. And, you know, we're seeing that a lot with walleye where they're just not reproducing, even in places where everything structurally looks fine. The habitat looks fine, but maybe the lake is warmer, or maybe because the ice isn't going out at the right times, there isn't food available for the walleye, the little walleye fry when they need it. So those are the type of situations that we are trying to address with stocking, while also working on some of those other issues too, right? We want to be able to restore spawning habitats when we have the opportunity to do that and try to create conditions where these fish can do it on their own. Because that's how it should be, right? And obviously that's more cost effective for us too, if we can get to that point.
So aside for warming water, what other conditions are making it difficult for the fish to do this naturally?
You know, musky would be another example here where they're fairly sensitive. And, you know, one of the things that we found in research is the more developed a lake becomes with people building cabins, taking out trees along shorelines, building boat ramps, whatever, the harder it is for muskies to reproduce. So that's the case where in a lot of, you know, sometimes we're just loving these lakes to death because we want to be on them. We want to be right there where the fish are. And sometimes it's hard for us to share that space in a way where the fish can still have all their healthy functions, you know, ecosystem functions that, as they did in the past. So that would be one, you know, one example. Another example is, you know, damming. That can fragment populations where maybe walleye or like a cold water species like trout used to run up a river and that's where they spawned. Well, if we build a dam, you know, maybe they can't get to the places they want to go to anymore. So those are the types of factors that we look at.
Your home for the Devil's Advocates with Dom and Crute. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6.
I like your stories and your reporting. Great show.
Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. The White House says President Biden met with G7 leaders today where they condemned Iran's attack on Israel and reaffirmed the G7's commitment to Israel's security. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby.
They also showed Iran that Israel does have friends, that there was a coalition that helps them support themselves. That alone is significant. And of course, the damage was extremely light.
While reassuring Israel that U.S. support is ironclad, Kirby saying that the U.S. does not want to see further escalation between Iran and Israel or a broadening battle in the Middle East. The U.S. was instrumental in preventing a large number of missiles heading toward Israel, intercepting nearly a quarter of the weapons before they reached their intended targets. Today, Iran warning the U.S. to keep out of any future hostilities between it and Israel. And this afternoon, an emergency meeting of the U.N. Security Council to discuss the developments in the Middle East. This is ABC News.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
The Packers on the road. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens. It happened this week. The Packers tailgate tour with six players visiting schools, social agencies, senior citizens, and presenting checks to donate to their programs. I spoke to Mark Murphy.
Our overall community impact this past year was over $12 million. It's a high priority for us is giving back.
You're being humble, but I know that you really light up some faces of fans, people who kind of maybe feel a little forgotten about, and they actually get to see you and your guys in person. I mean, it's tremendous.
Yeah, well, I think they really love seeing the players. I'm like an old man. Who's this guy? But, yeah, no, it's, yeah, this is our 18th tailgate tour. I think I've been on 16 now. It's really fun, especially at the stops at the schools, you know, to see the excitement. And usually it's a surprise. So when they see the players walk in, it's pretty exciting. And to see the interaction between them, it's a lot of fun.
Right. That's Packers president Mark Murphy with Sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price for your Sunday. Sunny skies at mid-70s for highs. Northwest winds will be rather light. Tonight, clear skies at mid-40s. On Monday, sunny, lower 70s expected, a southeast breeze, showers, even a few rumbles of thunder Monday night. Currently 77 degrees.
Progressive presents good news, bad news, dumb news, then great news. Good news. Your coworker Kyle said bundling home and auto insurance with Progressive could save you money. Bad news. While saying this, Kyle was eating your clearly labeled lunch. Dumb news. Pizza near work costs $7 a slice, and it tastes like drywall covered in ketchup. Great news. You decide to see if you could save money bundling at Progressive.com and enjoy more lunches far away from Kyle. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company affiliates and other insurers not available in all states.
Are you looking to kick up your night
from the city where the official bird is the plastic pink flamingo? This is Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX.
Hey, folks, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Cripescast with me, Charlie Behrens, on Civic Media. Here's my conversation with fisheries biologist for the Wisconsin DNR, Max Wolter. What about things like PFAS and microplastics and all that sort of stuff that we've heard so much about PFAS and the exposure in Wisconsin? What kind of impact does that have on the fisheries or the people who eat the fish?
Great. Yeah. Great question. Another big topic right now. You know, we've been doing contaminant testing in Wisconsin for a long time for some of the traditional things like mercury. You know, that's one that we've been monitoring for a long time. Fish biologists like me will go around to different lakes. We'll send in samples to the labs. They'll test for levels of contaminants. And then we'll report that to people so that they have that information and they can make decisions about where they want to eat. Harvest fish from to eat. So first thing I would do is just recommend anybody who's interested in that topic, go on dnr.wi.gov, search fish consumption guidance. And there's a whole document on there that's got a lot of this information. PFAS is kind of the new one on the scene. It's the one we're looking for, finding out where it's at, finding out the impacts it's having specifically on people and consumption of fish. We're finding that it behaves a little differently than some of the other contaminants. So it's definitely of interest, and I'm not the ultimate spokesperson for that. But again, if people are interested in that, I definitely recommend going on the website and reading up on some of the information there.
That sounds good. And just so people have a sense of it, can you define what PFAS is and sort of it comes from?
Yeah,
you don't want to go down this road.
I was wondering if you're it's fine. I was wondering if you're going to try to make me say the word that that acronym is for. So.
Oh, it's something big.
It's poly something something. Yeah, PFAS is an acronym, PFAS, and it's kind of a group of compounds, chemicals that are used in a lot of different industrial applications, and when they get into the water, they can also get into fish, and that can change change whether fish are healthy to eat or not from that water body. So we're finding we're doing a lot of testing for that around the state. That's a big emphasis for the current administration, and making sure we understand that and we can at least tell people, and then start to figure out how can we get that stuff out of there and keep these fish populations healthy for people to eat.
Is there any real issue? I mean, microplastics in the water, is that something that you guys study as well, or is that not necessarily your expertise?
That one's not quite my expertise. I know we have some partners that have looked at that. There's been some interesting work like out in the Apostle Islands and things like that. But that's not one that comes into my work on a day-to-day basis as much.
Got you. For fishers, people who enjoy fishing, what are some things that they can do? They see what's going on. They see that things are changing. They see that this is impacting their fishing. They love fishing. What are some things that people who are concerned about this can do and kind of take into their own hands?
That's a great question. A number of things. First, as you're traveling around fishing, be mindful of aquatic invasive species. Whether that's moving a boat around, make sure that boat's clean, drained, dry, all that stuff. Or even if you're just taking your bait bucket around, don't be introducing new minnow species or species of fish into new water bodies. That's a huge one. I mean, there's so much time and energy spent now on combating some of these aquatic invasive species. And when they get into a water body, they can have a lot of impacts that are very similar to some of the other things we talked about. They can change an ecosystem very quickly. So that's a big one, is just making sure everybody's doing their part to try to make sure that we aren't spreading things around. Another one would be for people, if you own a lake place or something like that, be mindful of kind of your environmental practices. The things we want to see happen are having wild shorelines with vegetation that creates habitat for fish right along that shoreline. The other thing it does is it keeps nutrients from flowing off of your property into the lake, which can speed up some of these processes of warming lakes, creating more demand for oxygen, which can hurt egg survival, things like that. So being good shoreline owners is another really big one. And then for folks that are doing the fishing themselves, making ethical choices, harvesting, just the number of fish you need, following the rules, following the limits, things like that. And then there's a whole bunch of other stuff like, be ready when you catch that big fish. Have the tools to be ready to release it if you're going to release a big muskie. Make sure you got the landing net. Make sure you got the pliers. Make sure you got a plan so you're not putting undue stress upon that fish and you can get it back on its way and release it in a way that's going to live. Nobody wants to have a fish die on them if they weren't planning on harvesting it. So that's something we're really, really preaching to people too, is good catch and release practices.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, especially with muskies. A lot of times you can catch a big muskie, you can release it, it swims away fine, but it's just basically going away to die. What is the best way to catch and release a muskie?
Great question. Yeah. So this is a big one, right? Because muskies at this point, it's 99 point something percent catch and release, right? Very few anglers are out there planning to harvest a muskie. Even if they catch a legal size muskie, there's replica mounts now. There's all sorts of options where you can take a picture, you can let that fish go, and you can feel good about it. But when you let that fish go, you're doing it with the expectation that it's going to survive. And like you said, there are cases, and it's more common than some people think, where the fish swims off and then it ends up dying because of the stress of being caught. So here's some things to consider. First off, we know the different factors that can contribute to stress when fish are caught. One is warm water temperatures. When it's really hot out, it's harder on fish. So that may be a time to just give them a break, go fish for bluegill or something else that isn't bothered as much by the heat. Another factor is catching fish from depth. And this is true across not just muskies, but other species. If you're pulling fish up from 30 feet or deeper, pulling them up really quickly, that can be pretty hard on certain species, and they can have a hard time swimming off after that. The other factors are handling time. So how long do you fight him? And then how long do you have him in the net? And even worse, how long do you have him out of the net and in the air, right? Try to keep him in the water, keep him wet. Get that hook out while it's in the net, have it all ready to go, get it up, get your picture, get it back in the water pretty quickly. That'll give the fish the best chance. If you're trying to take the hook off when it's in the boat and it's flopping around and banging on things, I know people are probably cringing just listening to that. That's the scenario where it's going to put a lot of extra stress on a fish that shouldn't be necessary if you're prepared for that scenario. Be ready to catch that muskie. Believe in yourself, really.
So in other words, you catch the muskie, you get it in the net, and then your recommendation is keep it in the net while you remove the hook, which sometimes, absolutely. I mean, that's difficult because it's flailing around and all that. Do you have any tips to sort of calm the muskie? I mean, I know that's like, hey, how do you calm a shark down? You know?
Yeah, positive affirmations. I don't know. The good news, I guess, in that scenario is if you have a fish that's still that feisty, that means it's in good shape, right? If it's still exerting all that energy and fighting against you, it's still in pretty good shape. It means you've gotten to that point without overexerting the fish. Give it a second to calm down. Try to get in a comfortable position. Use the tools that are available. And if the hooks are deep or they're just really difficult to get out, cut the hooks, let it go, buy a new treble hook. That might sound counterintuitive to some people to leave a piece of metal in that fish, but there's a lot of research that shows that that can lead to better outcomes for the fish. They can survive that in most instances, especially if the alternative is ripping in there and maybe catching a gill or something like that. That can be really bad. So if you're not able to get the hooks out quickly, leave them with the fish. They'll take care of it. It's pretty amazing.
Okay. So yeah, that I do remember hearing that as a kid, you know, like if the hook's in there deep, just cut the hook will rust away. Is that true?
Yeah, that's effectively how it works. They have the ability to kind of metabolize and deal with those hooks. And, you know, this is kind of like a whole category of research that we do on like our impacts on fish when we're fishing. And the research is pretty clear that, you know, yeah, cutting the line on a deep hooked fish is better than trying to wrench that hook back out of there.
Yeah. Interesting. Very interesting. So when it comes to, are you dealing with, trout as well in your, and so we have some of the best trout fishing, in Wisconsin in the driftless part of the state, and the driftless part, a lot of these are spring fed rivers. How, and at the same time, the driftless, if I'm not mistaken, is one of the areas of Wisconsin that might be most affected by climate change. Can you let us know why that is, A, and also B, how that would affect the trout fishing, if it would have a big impact or if the impact would be minimal because these are spring fed rivers and they are sort of naturally cooled?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Trout are awesome. Wisconsin has really one native species of inland trout, and that's the brook trout. But we also have introduced brown trout all over the place. Brown trout come from Europe, like some of our other species. Both trout species, but especially brook trout, are very, very reliant on cold water. They cannot survive in water that warms to kind of like normal summer temperatures that lakes are going to get to. So the places where trout do best are places that have really strong groundwater or spring water inputs. Out west, that also includes places where there's glacial meltwater up in the mountains. We don't have that here. So we're completely reliant on water infiltrating down through the soil, becoming groundwater, cooling, and then coming out into the trout streams at a fairly consistent, roughly 50 degrees Fahrenheit. That's perfect for brook trout. They love that. So the challenge is first making sure that that water becomes groundwater and not runoff water. Because if it's running off a parking lot at the grocery store and going straight into the trout stream, well, not only is it carrying all the stuff from the parking lot at the grocery store, it's also warm because it's just on blacktop. It's rainwater in the summer. It's going to be whatever, 75, 80 degrees. It's going to warm that stream right up. So that's why a big emphasis in a lot of watersheds is minimizing those impervious surfaces so that water can become groundwater, which is literally the lifeblood of those trout. But then the other challenge is, yeah, how does a warming climate impact trout? And just like the walleye that we were talking about earlier, A lot of the marginal trout streams where the temperature's already kind of like borderline, those are ones that might get pushed beyond their limit and trout may not be able to exist there anymore. And the places where trout are going to hang on and do best are the ones that have the strongest groundwater input, where it's just pumping out that 50 degree water and we expect it will continue to do that. So trout are definitely another one that's going to be very much impacted by climate change.
Got it. And are there things that we're kind of doing, like you mentioned the blacktop, are there things that we have in society kind of in mass that you think there's an alternative way we could do it that might be worth looking into? Like if there was sort of like a permeable blacktop, for instance, or some other material that would allow the water to be filtered more naturally than just have runoff?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would love to see something like that get developed. I guess I'm not aware of anything along those specific lines, but you know, we're always making recommendations to people about like rainwater, stormwater diversions. Protecting wetlands is really big. Because wetlands are a place where stormwater and excess surface water, flood water, all that can become trapped basically and allowed to kind of settle. So wetlands are a really important part of the picture and maintaining them. Minimizing impervious surfaces, especially in important watersheds. Those are the things that we have to do. And then another one with trout is maintaining connectivity. So many trout streams flow through culverts, right? There's tens of thousands of culverts around the state. And if trout can't pass through a culvert because it's not set at the right level, maybe there's a little lip between the bottom of the culvert and the stream and the water pours down, but they can't jump up. That can be a big problem because maybe there's good cold water upstream from there, but if the trout can't pass through a culvert, that's an issue. So that's been a big area of emphasis too, is finding those culverts, working with local townships to replace them, bringing some funding to the table, and trying to make it so trout can get to colder areas at certain times of the year.
We're coming up on spring, and this is obviously the time of the year where people will, you know, fertilize, pesticide, all that sort of stuff. What kind of an impact does that stuff have that we use for our lawn to try to make our lawn look whatever? And what does that impact have on the fisheries?
Yeah. I mentioned earlier, you know, especially on lake shores, we really want to minimize the amount of nutrients getting into lakes. And this is true for streams and rivers as well. And we do a lot of work with farmers, and farmers are actually really great about this. And there's some incredible success stories from the Driftless area, farmers really being the ones leading the way to minimize erosion, minimize nutrient inputs to streams. If you're a farmer, you don't want to lose those nutrients. You want to keep them, right? Because that's what's going to grow your crops. And so they've kind of led the way, and we've learned a lot. And now it's just a matter of applying those practices and getting people bought in. So when it comes to people's personal lawns, especially at their cabin or if they live near a stream, we do not want those extra nutrients that are going on a lawn winding up in that water body. That's going to lead to some nasty things like algal growth. It can increase the odds of fish kills because those nutrients have an oxygen demand associated with them. So the keys there are, you know, one, you know, maybe don't fertilize, maybe consider not doing that in some cases if you can get away with it. And then if you are going to fertilize, making sure that stuff's not getting into water bodies. So that includes, you know, having like a vegetated buffer between your lawn and the lake. That's going to prevent that material from running straight into the water body. And so that's a big area of emphasis. And when I go talk to lake associations, the thing I tell them is try to trick the fish into thinking nobody lives there, right? If the fish are looking up from the water and they're seeing a wild shoreline with trees and shrubs and undergrowth and all that, that's great. That's great. That's what we want to see. But if they're looking up and they're seeing a lawn, that's not as fish friendly.
Right. Sort of other thing I wanted to bring up is obviously we are, as I said, approaching spring, but, and I don't know if it'll happen this year. Historically though, there's sort of our second winter, third winter, whatever. Again, probably unlikely this year, but in the case that does happen, the first thing that's going to come out is the salt. What impact does salt have on walleye and other native fish?
I don't know if that's been well studied enough for me to really make a lot of strong conclusions about that. It's definitely something of interest, and I think we have some research partners looking into it, but I'm not sure. We use a fair amount of salt on our roads in the winter, and there's obviously a trade-off there. We want to have public safety. We don't need people skittering around and getting into accidents, but yeah, it's worth thinking about the impact that might have on the environment.
This is also a very important question. A few years ago, there was a mayor in Ohio who was talking about the dangers of prostitution while ice fishing. So I am curious, you know, you're the man out there. You're seeing the ice fishers. What is the real impact that prostitution has on ice fishing?
Where do we even start with this one?
I believe the ice shanty is where we start with it.
Maybe we're
or that's where it finishes. Yeah.
I think I became aware of this because of a clip that you did. And I was just, I was probably as flabbergasted as you were about what was going on there. I think we have to look at fishing culture, ice shanty culture as a net positive. And I don't think we should focus on, you know, maybe a few bad apples that might be doing whatever out there. I've never had any experiences like that on the ice.
I think it's a few bad eggplants is what we're really talking about here.
Those Wisconsin eggplants in the winter. Yeah.
They're a little smaller that time, cold out.
I will say this. How about this? This will be a semi-serious answer to your completely serious question. I know.
Yeah.
I don't see nearly as many permanent ice shacks as there used to be because the pop-up shacks have gotten so good. So there aren't a lot of cases on the lakes by me, at least anymore, where people are leaving a shack up for the whole winter. It's more come out, pop the shack up where you want it for the day. Not that, you know, something couldn't happen during the course of that day, but then they're taking the shacks off with them. So not as many permanent ice shanties with the new technology.
A lot of people pitching permanent ice shanties out there. So
I think if it's permanent, aren't you supposed to go talk to your doctor if it's more than like
I think if your ice shanty is standing for more than 4 hours, you must consult a medical professional. Thank you for reminding me for that PSA. Okay. Well, I'm glad that we were able to check that one off the box. Before we wrap up here, I just want to see if there's like anything sort of with wildlife related, either fishing or hunting or anything that kind of I missed out on or that you think would be important for people to know.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things we're talking about with this early spring is just opportunities that it provides to people. You know, we've kind of looked at some of the issues associated with climate change, but, you know, let's take a glass half full approach here. And we are opening up a lot of fishing opportunities for this early spring season so people can get out and enjoy this. When we have early ice out, we now have a catch and release bass season in March and April where people can go out and start fishing for bass earlier than they used to be able to. Panfish is open year round. We have more early season catch and release opportunities for trout. So I guess I would just say, you know, yeah, there's some weird stuff going on right out there right now with the weather, but make the most of it. Get out there, buy that new fishing license that kicks in on April 1. We'd appreciate it. that helps us keep stocking fish when they need to be stocked, keep doing habitat work, stay out on the water, doing surveys, letting people know where the good fishing opportunities are. If you're curious about, you know, where to go fishing and where to get started, go on the DNR website. We got a lot of great stuff from, you know, family shore fishing spots to some really awesome like interactive viewers where you can look at, you know, trout data and figure out cool stretches of trout streams where there's public access and stuff like that. There's so much out there. I mean, like you, I'm a kid who grew up fishing. That's how you become a fish biologist. You know, you start as a kid on a bike with a fishing pole and then you kind of just work your way up.
Yeah.
So, you know, I want to see more kids doing that. And that's been a big emphasis for me lately is kind of trying to create those opportunities, let people know what's out there, get that next generation fishing. Cause that's a concern, right? Is that maybe kids aren't as interested in this type of thing anymore. I like to think it created a generation of fairly well-adjusted adults with us, and hopefully it can do the same for the next generation if they find fishing and enjoy it.
Yeah. And I mean, I know that there are some out there that see fishing as like, oh, why would you do that to this fish or whatever? But I do think that people getting out and experiencing the outdoors and fishing and hunting is a big driver of what protects the environment for everybody else. There, as long as there's an economic incentive and people that is what fishing is. You know, it's an economic, people want to go vacation. They want to buy the stuff and all that. And then that keeps these populations, this wild area, protected from some real estate developer being like, you know what, let's get rid of all these trees and make whatever, you know? So, yeah. Very important. Last question I forgot to ask earlier. I read an article recently, just a headline, didn't actually read the article, that mercury levels, I believe in Lake Erie are, and I double check me on the lake if anyone's listening, but I believe they were talking about mercury levels being as high as they were in the 70s. Is that your experience? And I, here in Wisconsin, what are mercury levels like now? That's something we always hear with fishing. Where does the mercury come from? How have we gotten rid of it? And is it still a concern if you're eating the fish?
Sure. Yeah. So for mercury and other contaminants, you know, there's a couple ways of looking at it. Mercury can exist naturally in the environment. So there are some lakes that just naturally have higher levels of mercury, and it's not related to anything that people did. But then there's other cases where, yeah, some type of contaminant, mercury or others, is related to industry and a lot of bad environmental industrial practices in the past. And that Lake Erie area, I mean, that was the hotbed for it, right? That was all the big examples of burning rivers and things like that. I think we are on the right track. We're cleaning up a lot of those things. We're seeing a lot of systems getting a lot better. The Wisconsin River is an awesome success story. You know, you talk to people that grew up on that decades ago and what it was like. And now, you know, it's doing worlds better. So I think we are trending in the right direction with most of these. There are going to be some population or some fisheries that are just going to have high mercury levels, and we want to make people aware of that so they can make choices. So again, you know, go to that website and you can read about where you might want to know more about mercury. But yeah, I think generally, you know, in Wisconsin, I think we're doing pretty well. And we have great people working on it, both in the fisheries program and in other parts of the DNR that keep tabs on the people of Wisconsin's natural resources. That's our job. We don't manage them for ourselves. We manage them for everybody and want to have healthy, great functioning ecosystems, because it's important to our livelihood and our culture here in Wisconsin, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely is. Last question.
So, we're good.
Someone wants to get out, say, on Lake Winnebago right now, catch some walleye. Well, first of all, when can they start going out catching walleye? And when is it catch and release? When can you keep them? And what bait would you use?
Ooh, boy, you know, not being the Winnebago biologist, I'm going to be a little careful here and make sure I don't talk out of turn. But most of our large river systems are a continuous year-round season. So like the Wisconsin, the Mississippi, I believe the Wolf, you can go out and start fishing this time of year. I would recommend, you know, hang out for a little bit, maybe catch some crappies and bluegill for a while, and then come up and enjoy the Chippewa Flowage on fishing opener weekend up in my area. But if you are going to fish down there, yeah, you know, it's hard to beat a jig and a minnow. That's a classic for a reason. Yeah. Don't overcomplicate things. They make a lot of fancy smelling plastics and things like that. Jig and a minnow is still going to get it done. The fish are still pretty keyed in on that type of thing. So
yeah,
that's my advice. Don't overthink it. Don't fall for, you know, the latest, greatest packaging and marketing campaigns.
Keep it simple. Keep it simple.
Keep it simple. You can get too cute with it sometimes. Keep it simple.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, man, for coming on and giving us a little insight on the fishing this year. That was awesome.
Yeah, this was a treat. And thanks to everybody for tuning in and get out there, enjoy some Wisconsin fishing. It's awesome.
Cool. And apologies to all those aspiring ice fishing prostitutes out there. There's not as much of a market as some Ohio mayors may believe there is. So what can you do? What can you do? Thanks, man. This was great. I appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks for having me, Charlie.
Yeah, you bet. Well, have a good rest of your day, and we'll circle back when this is going to be released, probably in a week or two.
Week or two? Awesome. Yeah. Sounds good. All right.
Cool, dude.
Enjoy the day.
Thanks. You too. We'll talk soon.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, that is all the time we have for today. Special thanks to Max for coming on the Cripescast and giving us those insider tips on best places to fish, the best thing you can do for the environment to keep these fisheries sound. Make sure you follow what the DNR is doing. Follow them on social media. And if you have any questions or you want to get involved in your community, go to dnr.wisconsin.gov. And you can also follow the Cripescast anywhere you get your podcasts. It's just search the Cripescast, or if you're looking on social media, it's at Cripescast. Simple enough, ladies and gents. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Colleen Maraca, even though she's not here. Thanks to Hannah Milos, who actually is here sitting next to me, for producing and editing respectively. And last but not least, thanks to all of you. We'll see you guys next week. Okay. Happy Easter and watch out for deer.
So roll out the barrel and get the band brewing. Life's got you down, just keep her moving. It's on Wisconsin, the Badgers say it's the old Wisconsin Jubilee.
You know, sometimes when you're ice fishing, you put your foot into walleye hole and go ass over tea kettle and you think you're done. No, you gotta keep her moving.
Civic Media Global Headquarters on State Street. This is Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX.
Monday, I'm joined by movie producer Bob Brown and Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Chris Foran.
You're it's listening to Mad Wabba, Radio.
7 to 9 p.m. on Civic Media AM Radio Columbus, Network.
W224 EG Madison. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.